And now for something completely different.
This is the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Let's do it.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. With you till 3 on this Thursday with plenty to do over the next few hours. Coming up, the World Series, even at one apiece, heading back to Atlanta. Plus, the more things change in college football, the more they actually stay the same. And for a couple of programs in college football, they learn the lesson that you get what you put in. Plus, we'll start to look ahead to the weekend of football with the best Thursday night football game we have ever had tonight based off of winning percentages. We'll also talk fantasy football with Paul Charchi in a little bit later on. Lee Sterling will join us at 2 o'clock for his weekly picks for the football weekend. We'll catch up with Anthony Tresh from Pro Football Focus to talk about some quarterbacks and what has gone wrong with Clemson's quarterback. Also, James Franklin further leaves the door open to go to USC, and a whole lot more. Oh, we got to get to our wrestling wrap-up as well. We got a lot to do on a Thursday afternoon. With it till 3, with plenty to do between now and then. And you can join the conversation throughout the afternoon, 843-721-9500 to give us a call. You can text the show, 843-608-1734. Get to us on Twitter, at Morrow Middays. On Facebook, at ESPN Charleston. Via email, studio at kirkmanbroadcasting.com. Or online at charlestonsportsradio.com. Just click on our show page, and there you can leave a comment for the show. You can find the latest versions of the show podcasted right there, or you can even take the Morrow Midday Show with you wherever you go by simply streaming us online at charlestonsportsradio.com. With it till 3 on this Thursday, Joe's on the steel wheels. Joe, what's going on? How are you?
Hey, it's Friday Eve, and all is going well. How about you?
Yeah, not too bad.
And also, it's the Friday Eve before Halloween.
That's true. I was thinking about that this morning, driving in, and even a little bit yesterday. Maybe it's just me. It doesn't feel like Halloween week. I don't know. Joe, do you have any decorations up at the house? Do you get into the Halloween decorations?
We don't do the decorations, but my wife and I like to sit outside and hand out the candy.
Uh-huh.
And we might put on a costume or something to do that.
Did you pick up the candy? Do we know what we're handing out for Halloween?
Yeah, we had just had bags of like the, you know, the variety packs of like Nerds and Sweet Tarts and things like that.
Okay, solid.
We not usually bad. Get the Fun Dip, but it got more expensive this year. So.
Oh, inflation on the Fun Dip.
Yeah. So, of course, Bobby accuses me of trying to get kids hooked on cocaine because it's powder. So.
Oh, okay.
But then again, it's Bobby saying that, so go figure.
Yeah. So, well, that's good. No Fun Dip then this year. Hopefully everyone else is ready for Halloween. It just, to me, I don't know, it doesn't have the same feeling yet. I haven't seen as many decorations. I've been disappointed with the lack of some of the horror films on TV. I've been too busy watching World Series baseball anyways. And let me start with that. The Braves, of course, won game one. The Astros then bounced back last night, getting a much-needed victory. Can't fall behind 2-0. If you do, you only have about a 20% chance of winning that series. Not even just a World Series, but in playoff history, teams that go up 2-0 have won that series 74 out of 88 times, so just about 80%. So that was a must-win for Houston last night, and they came out and they played very well, and they did exactly what they had to. They got a win. Early offense, just like the Braves the night prior, put the game away somewhat early. The Braves hung around, still had a chance. It was a 3-run game midway through, but couldn't draw any closer, and the Astros tacked on with a few runs late to put the game away, even the series at one. And what we saw last night is what the Astros do. They struggled offensively in game one, struck out a bunch. They still struck out over 10 times last night. But when you look at their rallies, right, like in the first inning, it was a double, move over on a fly ball, score on a fly ball. In the second inning, when the Astros went for 4 more runs, they just peppered a few singles. And they weren't necessarily hit that hard. But with one out, you had a single from Tucker and then Gurriel with another single and then Jose Siri had the infield single, and then Maldonado, who was two for his last 31, gets a single that scores. You have the throwing error as well. Brantley gets a single. So you have five hits in that second inning, and they're all singles. Right, they scored their first five runs on six hits with only one going for extra bases. It was a double. In fact, the Astros became the first team in 3 years in the World Series to score five runs like that without a home run. That's really what Houston does. They're difficult to deal with. While they have struck out more in this series than normal, last night was the prototypical Astros offensive attack. They put the ball in play. They put some pressure on you. The Braves had a couple of errors. Right, they'll make you make plays, make you make pitches. They lead the league in runs scored with two outs. They lead the league in contact. They had the fewest strikeouts this year. And we saw that last night while, you know, they eventually did strike out over 10 times, but against Max Fried, Fried had only five swings and misses. Right, a lot of contact against him early on. And hitting the ball, not all that hard, but just putting it in the right spot. Seeing eye singles at times, and that could be frustrating for a team, but that's part of the attack of Houston when you go up against them. And they'll hit their fair share of home runs. Altuve got his later on throughout the regular season. You know, they were clobbering home runs this year. They're not quite like the Royals of 2014 that played quite a bit of small ball, stole bases, took an extra base, hit and ran, put pressure on you as a defense, slapped some singles around. They're not quite like that. They have plenty of power in this lineup. They hit plenty of home runs and extra base hits. But what you saw last night is the Astros offense at its best. That's what they do. Right, they contact you to death. Just put the ball in play, make you try to make plays, put together rallies with base hits. They'll throw a couple of homers in there, jumped out to an early lead, and they held on. And they even the series at one apiece, doing what they needed to. The Braves, however, did what they had to. More on that in a moment. But some sloppiness last night from Atlanta. And I saw an article written last night after the game blaming defensive shifts, which I know is a common complaint. People don't like the shift in baseball. I don't understand why. I don't get it. It's just like, to me, playing zone defense in basketball compared to man. There's a strategy to it. And if you know a guy's going to hit the ball in a certain place, you put a fielder there. It doesn't work 100% of the time. Sometimes the shift is going to hurt you. More often than not, it's going to help you. And if you go back and you look at the Atlanta Braves, actually, when they started to use more shifts as the season went on, their defense got a lot better. They rely a lot on shifts. Sometimes it just doesn't work. Most of the time, it does. Nothing's 100%. But you base it off of the data and you know, hey, more often than not, a guy hits it over here. Sometimes he won't. But I saw an article written about the shifts used by the Braves last night as some sort of talking point from that game. It's a non-story to me. Again, sometimes the shifts won't work. More often than not, they will. That's why you're shifting the fielders there, because that's what the data suggests, and it usually works out. Now, for the Braves in losing that game last night, the real concern is with the rotation. Right, Max Fried didn't pitch all that great. He gave you length, which was important. There was two philosophies Brian Snicker could have went by last night. You could try to pull Fried early when he didn't have it. Right, it's a 5-1 game in the second inning. You could pull him at that point and then bring him back on short rest, say, in game five. I mean, they may still do that, but it'd be easier to do it on fewer pitches last night. But the problem is, the night prior, when Charlie Morton left, you had to get almost seven innings out of your bullpen. And so if you took him out after the second inning last night, there was a chance you may have to get another seven innings, depending on what your offense did, six or seven innings out of your bullpen, and you just can't tax them like that. So it was almost pick your poison. And Fried, while he didn't have his best stuff, got them at least some length, some innings. Save that bullpen. The bullpen will be rested heading home, which is important because who knows who's going to pitch game four or five. They could both be bullpen games. But this is the concern now for the Braves after losing Charlie Morton in game one. That when you look at that pitching rotation, the advantage that they had was that depth. Then you lose Morton. Okay, now you have to rely a little bit more on Fried and Anderson. Well, then Fried last night goes out there and pitches like that in a loss. And Fried, who had the number one ERA in the league since the All-Star break, hasn't held up his end of the bargain here in the postseason. In his career in the playoffs, a 4.53 ERA in 16 career appearances. Not great. But this year, more recently, in his last three starts in the playoffs this year, a 7.47 ERA over his last three starts. Last night, Fried allowed the most runs of any Braves pitcher in World Series history for one game. That was the worst start just based off of runs allowed by any Braves pitcher in a World Series game in the history of the franchise. And if you already lost Morton and can't count on him, you need to be able to count on Max Fried. Because otherwise you're down to Ian Anderson tonight, a couple of bullpen games. Then you can't go back to Morton. He's unavailable. You go back to Fried game five or six. You hope he's got better stuff. But a disappointing effort last night from your star, from your ace, who's pitched so great from July on. When you needed him last night, sure, it's fine. You take a split, you head back home, but a chance to go up 2-0 without Charlie Morton needing that start, and you didn't get it. The good news is he did give you length. And if you're the Braves, you look at the first two games in Houston, you got one start where your pitcher didn't make it through the third inning. You got another start where your pitcher made it to the sixth inning. And if you told Brian Snicker that before those two games, he would probably take a split. You'd figure the win would come when the pitcher would go a little bit longer, and the loss would come when your pitcher comes out in the third inning. So either way it happens, flip it and reverse it, and it doesn't matter, you still split the two games. You'll take that. And because Fried gave him some length last night, again, the bullpen will be a little more rested with today's day off heading into Game 3 tomorrow night in Atlanta. So that, in that sense, was a big help. And now you get to Game 3, and these are always big swing games when the series are tied, right? A 2-2 series, Game 5 is huge, of course. A 1-1 series early on, Game 3 can be big. And in Game 3 tomorrow night in Atlanta, we'll have two rookies going up against one another. The first time in a World Series game, two rookies are pitching against one another for the first time in 16 years. Now, Ian Anderson pitched last year in the playoffs, made a handful of regular season starts, but he did not throw enough innings to qualify, so he is technically a rookie this year, hence the stat. So, and Garcia, I believe the same way for the Astros. I believe he made a few starts last year, but not enough to qualify for a season. So they're both technically rookies this year. And for Garcia, right, the question becomes, okay, which rookie can step up in this big spot? Because Anderson was really good in the postseason last year and so far this year. In his career, he's been fantastic in the postseason. A 1.5 ERA in 7 starts, 3-0 record, but it becomes a little bit different when it is the World Series. And it helps that he will be at home instead of on the road for this first World Series start of his. On the other side, you have Garcia getting the start tomorrow for the Astros, who isn't nearly as good on the road as he is at home. His ERA increases by 2 runs on the road compared to in Houston. The Braves will have to try to jump on him tomorrow night. But Garcia did not pitch very well his first few outings this postseason, and then turned it on in, what was that, game 5 or 6 of the ALCS, his last appearance. He was excellent. And Garcia also added that night about 4 miles onto his fastball. He threw the hardest pitches of his career that night, which seemed a little odd. And the Astros told you, yeah, it was a mechanical thing. They changed his foot placement on the rubber. He could push off of the mound a little bit better, and he's throwing harder now and faster. So I'm curious to see what Garcia we get tomorrow night, not just because of the moment, a World Series game on the road in what should be a crazy environment in Houston, but also because what Garcia will we get? The one that pitched so well last time out, the best game really of his career, or the one who struggled in his previous two outings prior to that in the postseason? Which Ian Anderson are we going to get? The one who has been so good in his playoff career, or in his first ever start in a World Series, will he shrivel up a little bit, you know, like the rookie that he still technically is? It's a big spot for these two pitchers tomorrow night, and we'll see which one comes out, you know, on top with the advantage. Which one can you rely on more tomorrow night to try for both these teams to take back the early lead? But at the end of the day, while the Braves didn't play great last night and they're coming off a loss and they head home, it's 1-1, you did what you had to do. You split on the road. And we talked about this on the show yesterday, but that's that goal of that team on the road to begin the series. You steal home field advantage, you head back home now, you have a chance to just win this thing in Atlanta if you could play good ball and win the next three. It may be unlikely, but it's a possibility. You did what you had to do. And last night, Fried gave you enough length that bullpen, you didn't have to use any of your big-time arms, it'll be rested enough. You hope you get a good start from Ian Anderson, you'll have your arms ready, and then figure out game 4 and 5 as you go. Maybe you bring back Fried on short rest in game 5. You go bullpen in game 4. Maybe somebody like Drew Smyly. You hope you can piece it together. You hope Fried has his good stuff next time. But the Braves did what they had to. It'd be great to go up 2-0. Gives you about an 80% chance of winning the series. But you needed to just split. And by the way, maybe it's just some sort of random stat. Maybe it's the causation versus correlation. But teams that have won Game 1 in the World Series have gone on to win the actual series 20 of the last 23 years. When you start off with that victory, right, it gives you a big edge. You just have to play 500 ball the rest of the way. The Braves return home now for what should be a wild time tomorrow night in Atlanta. First home game in the World Series for the Braves, right, in quite some time. They've lost five straight home games in the World Series, but they've been very good at home recently. 5-0 in the postseason at home. Their last loss at home was back on October 1st, 4 weeks ago, and they haven't lost back-to-back games at home since September 15th, a month and a half ago, which is crucial, right? Because even if you drop one of these games, they've been very good, so good at home, it's tough to beat them on back-to-back nights. You hope to at least win two out of three at home, and if you have to return to Houston, at least you'll do it with a 3-2 lead, having two opportunities just to win one game. The Braves lost last night, but they still accomplished their goal of splitting in Houston. Let's hear from the manager of the Braves, Brian Snicker, talking to the media after last night, talking about exactly that, about the Braves getting the job done, heading back home, and his thoughts on Max Fried, who was a bit of a letdown last night for the Braves in his first World Series start.
No, good. You know, when we came in, you want to split. I think that's, you know, obviously you want to win too, but if you get out of here with a split, then that's a good thing going home.
Snit, were you at all surprised that Max struggled early after the, you know, having a pretty bad start the last time out? I mean, then he settled in and was himself.
I'm having a hard time convincing myself that he struggled that much. I mean, it was, you know, the first inning, they did some really good hitting. The second inning when they scored, it was kind of a weird inning. You know what I mean? It wasn't like he was getting banged around, you know, balls that found holes, check swings, it was just, we threw a ball away. I mean, it was just a weird inning. But I thought his stuff was really good. you know, he ended up throwing a lot of pitches for the five innings he was out there. But, God, I mean, it could have been very easily a different outcome for him, I think, especially in that second inning.
Snit, you've won 10 of the last 11 at home, undefeated at home in the postseason. How much do you attribute that to the atmosphere at Truist?
Well, I think it's great. The atmosphere is awesome. Like I say, Braves country's real. It's real. That's why I think it was so important to split here. I mean, realistically, you want to win two, but if you can split and get out of here and go home where we've been really good, that's a very positive, I think, that we're going to go home on tomorrow.
Snicker after the game last night. Yeah, when you end on the loss, right, I always reference the Dennis Green line, how you feel about your record depends on when the wins happen and when the losses happen. A 5-2 team on three straight wins feels different than a 5-2 team that lost the last two. So when you win game one, lose game two, maybe you don't feel quite as good because you just lost the most recent result. But when you look back, you realize, right, hey, that's all we had to do, just split. Whether it was game one or game two, you also lose Charlie Morton in the process. You did what you had to. Now moving forward, you have to piece together this rotation and hope to get a better outing from Max Fried next time out. Right, maybe he didn't pitch terribly. Maybe he had his stuff, but he did allow five runs in the first two innings. Maybe they were seeing eye singles. They weren't hit all that hard. Still, you surrendered five runs in the loss. Made it hard on your team when they're down 5-1 in the second inning to try to come back. And I can refer back to my tiers of clutchness once again. We're in the top tier, right? You have the greatest ever do it that get even better in the big moments. And the next tier, you have great players who become all-time greats in the postseason. And then you have great players that continue to be great. And then the bottom tier are the players that aren't all that great but become really clutch in the postseason. And then at the very bottom, the lowest level of clutch hell in this sense is the players who are really good in the regular season and struggle in the postseason, a la Peyton Manning, Paul George, Alex Rodriguez, and Greg Maddux had that reputation. He was still good in the postseason, but not quite as good in the regular season. And while Max Fried has pitched well in the postseason at times in the past, right, career ERA in the playoffs of over 4.5, this season 7.5 in his last three starts, he was the ace and the best pitcher in baseball for the second half of the season this year. But he's not holding up his end of the bargain right now in the playoffs, and he has to without Charlie Morton. So too does Ian Anderson. He needs to step up in Game 3 tomorrow night in his first career World Series start. He's been very good in his postseason career. And Ian Anderson caught up with Paul Byrd on site last night after the game to look ahead to Game 3 in Atlanta.
It's been awesome. You know, to hear the crowd roaring last night, I think it's going to be all that more special when we're at home for Game 3. And it's exciting, you know, to be in this position. It's not something that we necessarily thought we would be here in, June, but we're kind of taking it all in, and we're playing pretty well.
Luke Jackson says you're like 65 years old. You're like an old soul that nothing bothers him. Will we see that calm, cool, and collected Ian on the mound?
Yeah, I think that's kind of what I try to embody out there. And, you know, it's helped me quite a bit. You don't want to give the other team anything to kind of feed off of. Cause, you know, I think especially in games like this, the postseason, that's sometimes what you can be looking for. And, I try to be calm. And I feel like I'm wiser than my age for sure.
How about Charlie Morton, your buddy, pitching with a broken leg?
Yeah, that's the embodiment of him and this team. You know, it's to do what he was able to do. We're definitely pulling for him to you know, come back healthy next year and going to try to win this thing for him.
Ian Anderson last night as he gets ready to pitch in Game 3 tomorrow. Which rookie will be better tomorrow night, Garcia or Anderson? First time in a World Series we have two rookies starting against one another on the mound since 2006. And by the way, that was when Justin Verlander was a rookie. And he, if he was healthy, would be pitching in this World Series for the Astros. Braves didn't play great last night, but they split, and that's what you had to do. And the Astros, that was more like Astros baseball. They have now scored 46 runs this postseason with two outs, which is tied for the second most in a single postseason all time. That's what they do. They put the ball in play. They're very tough and frustrating. They battle with two strikes with two outs. They'll contact you to death, make you have to make some plays. And after struggling in Game 1 and being shut down, that looked more like an Astros offensive attack last night to even the series. We'll see what happens in Game 3. First home World Series game in years for the Braves. And Ian Anderson on the bump tomorrow night. When we come back, the more things change in college football, the more they may actually stay the same. We'll get to that coming up. It's the Moore Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
It's Throwback Thursday.
What's today? It's Thursday.
Really? Feels like Tuesday.
Tuesday has no feel. Monday has a feel. Friday has a feel. Sunday has a feel.
I feel Tuesday and Wednesday.
All right, shut up, the both of you.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
Inside my car, I got pictures, got candy, I'm a lovable man, and I can take you to the nearest star. I'm your vehicle, baby. I'll take you anywhere you wanna go.
Coming up, the more things change, the more they stay the same in college football. But there is still a chance for some more chaos this year. It's the Moore Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. I guess this could be a fitting song for the weekend with Halloween coming up. That was my other thought. When are we going to get into Halloween-themed music? There's not a lot to choose from. It's something I complain about every year. We got all sorts of Christmas songs. We need more Halloween songs.
We're going to have that same problem with Thanksgiving.
Yeah, but Thanksgiving, I don't care so much about the music. People need to write more songs about turkeys. But we need more Halloween songs, right? We haven't had a new Halloween song in years. Now, I watched Halloween Kills the other night, the new Michael Myers movie. There was a great song they used in that movie. It's a good Halloween song. So we'll have to throw that on the playlist. I haven't heard that ever before, and it was a pretty good one. But we need more Halloween music, like songs actually about Halloween instead of just Monster Mash, the classics that you always play. Thriller, Somebody's Watching Me, the same like five songs that you have on repeat. You knew the neighbor who they have the music going when you come get the candy. It's the same songs over and over again. There's only so much Halloween songs you can play.
And then, like I said, there's, you know, Halloween movies. Of course, you have the monster movies, you have the thriller movies, you have the horror movies and stuff like that.
Yeah.
There's a few comedies, like I mentioned, Hollywood Nights and Fun Size. But also, I think Madea did a couple of Halloween movies.
Oh, yes, that's right. I haven't seen any of the Madeas. You ever deal with somebody and you realize they can't change? Like maybe you take somebody back in a relationship, or maybe an employee burns you, but you give them a second chance because you're a nice guy, you're a good person. They let you down, but you realize, yeah, maybe they just made a mistake. We'll give them another chance. You welcome back an old girlfriend or boyfriend, or, you know, God forbid, you deal with somebody who has to deal with, like, substance abuse. or some sort of addiction. And they always tell you, at this time, it's going to be different. And for a while, it may seem different. You may look around like, oh, yeah, you know what? Actually, it is a lot better. You get back into that relationship again. And you see, like, oh, this is a lot better than I remember. Things are good. I'm happy again. But eventually, we are who we are, and you fall into old habits. And whatever led to the problems the first time, unfortunately, are probably going to show themselves again. Somebody burned you at work, an employee, whether they weren't working hard enough or who knows, maybe they stole from you or whatever. They blew a huge sale. They cost you a lot of business. And you give them a second chance, and then you realize, like, well, that's just kind of who they are because it happens again. Things are going well, and you think maybe it will be different this time. They're working harder. They're doing a good job. Haven't had to worry about them. And then after a few months, something slips, and you realize, like, yeah, you know what? This was a mistake. It's not going to work. After a few months in that relationship, you remember what the problems were the last time. The honeymoon phase is over. You guys are going at each other all the time, always yelling, fighting, and you realize, like, yeah, this just isn't a good match. I don't know why we thought this would work. Or somebody who, you know, is trying to stay clean, and you're dealing with them, and everything seems to be good, and they've cleaned themselves up, and they're, you know, they got a good job, but then unfortunately, you know, maybe something happens down the road, and you realize, you know what, it's the same thing every time. You keep telling me it's going to be different, and yet the same thing happens. In college football, we've had more upsets this year than ever before. We've had more chaos in college football. And with the college football playoff rankings coming out on Tuesday, the first of the year, still, when you look at college football, the more things change, the more they're really staying the same. Just like those people you give a second chance to. You get back into a relationship, and for a while, it seems like it is different, and this is great, and we're having fun, and then a couple of months go by and you realize, actually, it's the same thing. We're having the same problems we were having last time we tried this. And in college football, right, early in the season, all sorts of upsets and this and that. But you look at the rankings now, and it comes down to Georgia. Alabama are the two best teams in football still. Cincinnati is the best Group of Five team once again. The difference may be that they could actually make the playoff this year. That hasn't happened in the past, so there's the difference. But you look in the Big Ten, Ohio State's the highest-ranked team, and I do think they're the best team in the Big Ten once again. You look at the Big 12, and, well, Oklahoma is the best team in the Big 12 once again. You look at the Pac-12, yeah, Oregon, in recent memory, they've been the top program. But also, the Pac-12 is kind of being ignored, just like it has been. The one difference, the one surprise, other than, I guess, Cincinnati getting all the way up to number two, I mean, sure, you could tell me Michigan. Maybe people didn't expect Michigan to have this start, or certainly Michigan State. We'll see if they can actually finish off the job and win the Big Ten. But otherwise, the one surprise really is Clemson. That's the big thing. Clemson's the one, you know, they've almost been like the fall guy in all of this. We were told this is going to be a crazy year, and it has been. But when it comes to picking the playoff teams, it's probably going to be pretty similar outside of Clemson not being there. Right now, you're looking at potentially a Georgia, an Alabama, Ohio State, and then, yeah, maybe a Cincinnati. Or maybe they get bumped for an Oklahoma for all we know. If Oklahoma wins out, they go undefeated, they win the Big 12, they would be in. And then the debate could come down to if Ohio State runs the table and they win the Big 10, and Alabama, say they beat Georgia. And so all three of those teams, Georgia, Alabama, Ohio State, all have one loss. Would the committee leave one of them out for a Cincinnati, even if Cincinnati's undefeated? And that's if Cincinnati gets past SMU in a couple of weeks. We very well could end up with a pretty standard playoff field once again. Right? The more things change, the more they stay the same. It seemed like it was going to be different this year. All sorts of chaos, upsets, and then by year's end, we're talking about the same teams, having the same debates, and we'll most likely have a very similar playoff field. But with that said, there is still a chance for things to go off the rails. We still have an opportunity to really mix things up and get even more chaos. That's the first course of action I just laid out. Right? That's like plan A or option A. That's the first way things could go. Alabama could beat Georgia in the SEC title game, probably putting both in the playoffs. Ohio State could run the table the rest of the way, probably putting them in the playoff. Oklahoma could run the table the rest of the way, probably putting them in the playoff. That's like the no more chaos path. And then you'd end up with probably those four, or one gets left out for Cincinnati, but that would be a very tough call for the committee. And those are the schools you'd be looking at, which is pretty standard. Or we could get chaotic. Maybe Georgia loses to Florida on Saturday. They are a two-touchdown favorite, but what's the old cliche, right? When it comes to rivalries, throw the records out the window. Dan Mullen is much like Mike Tomlin and the Steelers. They play to the level of their competition. He'll lose games to LSU when they're favored by, you know, three touchdowns, and then they'll play Alabama to a field goal. Right? And they'll beat Georgia last year as an underdog. So, Dan Mullen, don't count him out on Saturday against Georgia, as good as they are. Right? Maybe Alabama, maybe they lose the Iron Bowl to an Auburn team that's playing really well. And they don't even get to the SEC title game. They have two losses, and they're left out of the field. Maybe Oklahoma loses along the way to an Oklahoma State, or they lose in the Big 12 championship, and with one loss, maybe the committee feels that's enough to keep them out. Or Ohio State. First, they have Penn State up this weekend, just the second-ranked team they've faced this year, and then eventually we'll have to face Michigan, who very well could still be undefeated at that point, and a top-six team. And maybe Michigan beating Ohio State, and somebody else goes on and wins that Big Ten, and they go to the playoff. If Wake Forest runs the table, and they win the ACC and go undefeated, they're currently ranked 13th. Could they climb the ladder so much that we would put Wake Forest in the playoff if they finish the year as an undefeated ACC champion? Or Cincinnati could run the table and very well stay where they are at the number two seed as the first group of five in the playoff. So far, it looks like the more things change, the more they stay the same. And it's easier to count on these top programs to not let you down, to expect that Georgia will run the table. After Florida, they don't have any more tests in the regular season. It's easy to believe Alabama, they're not going to lose again. But maybe they will. It's easy to believe Ohio State, yeah, they're the best team in the Big Ten. They'll be fine. Maybe Michigan will beat them for the first time under Harbaugh. There could be some chaos. That would be the second path, the second chance, where this thing does get really screwy here in the last couple of weeks. But you expect that those top programs will take care of business. You expect to be a lot of the usual suspects once again in the college football playoff. When it comes to the SEC in particular, Georgia, if they get past Florida on Saturday, as they should, they're in the clear until the SEC title game. They won't lose or really be tested the rest of the way. But where things could get interesting in the SEC is in the West. Alabama currently is in first place. But Alabama does have to face Arkansas, who knows, and they do have to face Auburn in the Iron Bowl. That could be a tough game. And Ole Miss is right behind them, a half game out. Ole Miss has one loss. Their only loss was to Alabama. So if Ole Miss could run the table and get a little help, Alabama loses one more game in the regular season, say they lose to Auburn. And Ole Miss would have to beat Auburn this week. And Ole Miss still plays two more ranked teams, Texas A&M as well. But if Ole Miss runs the table, Alabama loses one more game, Ole Miss goes to the SEC championship. And then you have the aforementioned Auburn Tigers, who actually control their own destiny because they play Ole Miss this Saturday at home, and then they play Alabama at the end of the year also at home. If they beat Ole Miss, there's loss number two for Ole Miss. If they beat Alabama, there's loss number two for Alabama. And all three teams would have the same record, but Auburn would have beaten those other two programs at two losses. And oh, by the way, Texas A&M also has two losses while Auburn plays Texas A&M next week. So there is still a chance for chaos, and if there's chaos in the SEC, it could actually come from the Auburn Tigers. They control their own destiny. The three teams that they'll be competing with are three teams still left on their schedule. Ole Miss this Saturday, followed by Texas A&M next Saturday, and then they end the year, of course, with Alabama. And two of those three are at home. If I had to guess, if I had to predict, right, the safe money would go on predictability. Count on Georgia and Alabama and Ohio State to do their thing and take care of business, and Oklahoma as well. And despite having the most chaotic regular season and more upsets than ever before, we still end with a pretty similar playoff field. But there is a chance for some last-minute chaos that can really shake things up. And when it comes to the SEC specifically, it's kind of in the hands of Auburn if they could run the table the rest of the way. Coming up, we all know the saying, the cliche, the expression, right? You get what you put in, you get what you give. There was even a song in the 90s about it. Same goes for college football teams, and we'll get to that next. It's the Morrow Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
You're listening to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Coming up. In life, they say you get what you put in. And it's no different in college football either. It's the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. We'll talk fantasy football with Paul Ciarci, and as we do every Thursday, coming up at 1:25 this afternoon, as we start week 8 of the NFL season with a great Thursday night football game tonight. Some injuries, so it's not quite as good on paper as it was just about a week ago. And when I say injuries, that also includes some COVID issues for the Packers. But still, it's the highest winning percentage of any Thursday night matchup we've had this late in the season since they began playing Thursday night football. Just one loss between the two teams. Rodgers against Murray. Should be a lot of fun tonight. We'll start to look ahead in a little bit. You know, you probably heard the cliche, the expression. Maybe you live by it. You get what you put in, or you get what you give. There was even a one-hit wonder in the 90s that wrote a song about it. Right, you get what you put into things. It's much like you got to spend money to make money. Yeah, here's the song. Joe tells me they were a two-hit wonder. They had a second hit, huh?
Yes, they did.
Oh.
Yeah, I think it's called Someday We'll Know.
Oh.
Or Something We'll Know.
I'm not familiar with that one. The New Radicals.
Yeah, that was kind of a minor hit.
This guy's gone on to have a pretty good career. He like writes a lot of music for people. Not so much himself anymore.
Yeah, he decided just being a rock star wasn't for him, so he'd rather do something else in music, so yeah. Write and produce.
Yeah, in this song, he calls out other like successful musicians about kicking their ass or whatever he says later in the song, which was very bold for an unproven band on their first hit. But a classic from the 90s. I'm sure you recall this song. It was a good song back in the day. It's the message I'm speaking about, and we've talked about this before. You get what you give, right? You get what you put in. The Beatles had a great line about that as well. You get as much love as you give. But the whole point, I bring this back to college football for a couple of different things. You know, right now we have the LSU coaching job open and the USC coaching job open. And LSU has always been, I shouldn't say always, but more recently has been more devoted to the football program than seemingly USC has been. USC hung with Clay Helton a little too long. LSU moves on from Ed Orgeron less than two seasons after winning a national championship. USC is a little more concerned with the buyout. LSU will spend $17 million just on Ed O to go away. They'll spend more on his coaching staff and then spend more on bringing in a new coach, all to get rid of somebody who won them a national championship 2 years ago. And we know, you know, in the SEC, it just means more, as they say, and that probably is true. Also in the SEC, granted, you do make a little more money being in the SEC than you do being in the Pac-12. But for USC, they have the fifth richest alumni base in the country of all the colleges. USC, if you take all of their alum and the money they're making, fifth highest amount of money. So when you want to talk about buyouts or investing money into a football program, you got some pretty good boosters, or at least alum, that you could try to hit up. Additionally, California has the fifth best economy currently in all of the world compared to Louisiana is or Baton Rouge, whatever. You want to take the area, not so much the state, but the town itself is 50th in the country for LSU. But LSU devotes more resources. They're more interested. They care more about the program. They'll probably be the ones to hire the better coach in this search compared to, from them to USC, because you get what you put in. That's why LSU, last three coaches have won national championships. They bring in a different coach. They still have success. They're one of the best teams in college football more often than not, you know, over the past 20 years. USC had a great run with Pete Carroll. Since then, they've been an average program. We'll see which head coach, right, the programs that hire the two head coaches, but you feel pretty confident that LSU will get a better head coach. And why? A big reason is because it seems like they care more, and they devote more money to football, to getting it right. They'll pay $17 million for Ed O to go away, just to move on from a coach that just won you the national championship, not to mention how much they're going to pay for the next guy. And so we got this information this week along the same lines about Clemson and South Carolina and their spending habits. And according to the state auditor, Clemson spends approximately 42% of their budget on football. South Carolina spends 25% of their budget on football. And the Gamecocks, being in the SEC, they do make more money being in the SEC than a team would in the ACC. So when you talk about percentage, that could still be, you know, you're still spending a lot of money. But the portion of the pie, Clemson invests almost half of their budget into the football program. They have the highest paid assistant coaches. Dabo is the highest paid. They pump money in, and you get what you give. Clemson has had a lot of success lately. For South Carolina, spending only a quarter of their budget on football has certainly, as a program, been lackluster. Now, in the defense of the Gamecocks, when it comes to the coaches, Shane Beamer is a first-time, first-year head coach. So what would you expect? But he is the lowest-paid coach in the SEC, even behind Sam Pittman. We don't know about Clark Lee at Vanderbilt. They're a private school. They don't release that information. Eli Drinkwitz at Missouri, though, in his second year, coming from a Group of Five school, is making almost twice as much at Missouri as Beamer. Josh Heupel in his first year, granted he was a coach previously, but first year at Tennessee, he's making almost twice as much as Shane Beamer. And you know the money is there for the Gamecocks because they're in the SEC as well, and they just spend it elsewhere. As I mentioned, 25% of their budget goes to the football program.
Also, that kind of ties into something you were talking about with Jeremy Schilling yesterday about, you know, you were asking me, would you rather, you know, lose and make more money,
yeah,
or win and make less money, but have, you know, options to, you know, maybe get the endorsement deals and things like that.
Uh-huh.
Is Carolina kind of that way in the SEC as far as losing and taking the bigger paycheck?
Yeah. I mean, Vanderbilt more so as well. Vanderbilt's never going to win. They'll compete in baseball. But it's like, hey, we're in the SEC, so not only do we get the publicity, but we also get the paycheck. That's nice. That's why any team would jump at the opportunity to jump into the SEC, even if it gives them, you know, even if it puts them at a disadvantage. In fact, you could say the same thing about Texas and Oklahoma right now, that things are going to get worse for them once they join the SEC. But, right, you see dollar signs, and you make that move. But for South Carolina, I think what the most interesting part is the amount of money that they devote to the women's basketball team. And what's the most successful program at South Carolina? The women's basketball team. So it could be a little bit of a chicken and the egg. What happened first? Right? Did they start to have success and the school then started to pump more money into it, or vice versa? Did they start to pump some of the money in as that program was then becoming more successful? But they spend $7 million on the South Carolina women's basketball team. Therefore, the women's basketball team operates at a $4 million deficit. Right, a lot of other programs don't have that large of a deficit. If you're not making money, it's hard to then pump more money into something. Like if you're running a company and you're not doing very well, I don't know if you want to pump more money into that company. It may just be a bad idea, just a dead company. You're just wasting, you're throwing money away. For the women's basketball team, that's not the case because they're successful. But you're taking a larger portion of the budget and putting it over there knowing you're not going to get that money back. But it's worth it because of the success of the team and the interest that you have in making sure that that program is successful. The Gamecocks take a larger portion of that pie, give it to women's basketball, smaller portion of the pie, give it to the football program. The women's basketball program, highly successful. The football program hasn't been good enough of late. Then you look over at Clemson. The basketball programs don't get quite as much of the pie or the portion. More goes to football. And football, of course, is the best program there with the Clemson Tigers, historically, or at least in recent history, outside of this year. But you get what you give. You got to spend money to make money, just like at your company, right? You pump more money into the strongest part of your company. If your company revolves around sales, usually the salespeople are the most important. And you pump in more resources to allow them to do a better job because they're the ones that are going to make you the money. LSU and USC, you trust LSU will make the better hire because they're the ones that seem to care more. They put more money into their program. They'll buy out Ed O. USC's kind of waiting around for Clay Helton, right, for that buyout to drop down a little bit, giving him more time. We don't need to get rid of him yet, even though he's been on the hot seat for years. The teams that spend more are the ones that are going to be more successful. We see that in professional sports. The teams that go out and are aggressive and make moves, the Braves, the trade deadline, the Dodgers, this in the last 3 years, every offseason, they're the ones that are going to have more success. When you commit more to something, you will have more success come from it. And the data backs it up when you look at Clemson and South Carolina. Clemson's devoting more to their football program. South Carolina, a little bit more to their women's basketball program.
Now, the chicken and the egg thing,
yep.
Was that a pun? South Carolina, the Gamecocks.
No, you know? No pun intended. I didn't think of that. But yes, that applies as well. We'll wrap up Hour 1 when we come back. It's the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Now back to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Feel your dreams again.
Wrapping up hour one here on the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. It's like a two for Thursday, bringing back the New Radicals.
We didn't get to the chorus, so
no,
just to be fair.
Yeah, you didn't hear the whole point of the song. There it is. You get what you give. That's today's lesson. Let that be a lesson on this Thursday afternoon here on the Morrow Midday Show. Classic 90s hit from the New Radicals. But in anything that you do, life, business, relationships, you get what you give. You get what you put in. And when you look around college football, the teams that care the most are the ones that are having the most success, the teams that are pumping in the most money or resources. The ones that are lagging behind a little bit, well, they're also kind of lagging behind as well when it comes to standings or building their programs. South Carolina chooses to devote more resources to the women's basketball team, and you can understand why. It's been a highly successful program. Clemson, financially, all in on the football program, and, well, you can see why. It's been a highly successful program as well. Speaking of which, we'll hear from Dabo coming up. We'll also hear from James Franklin, who further, I don't know if he'd say put his foot in his mouth, because he meant to say what he said yesterday. But I don't think he's making Penn State fans feel comfortable right now. And we also will circle back to Mike Tomlin. Something dawned on me yesterday about that audio clip. Plenty to do coming up in hour two. It's the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.